Russia says it will take countermeasures in response to Finland and Sweden joining the U.S.-led NATO military alliance. A group of lawmakers in the European Union calls on the bloc to hold Israel accountable for the murder of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. And Australia joins the U.S., Canada, and several European countries in detecting cases of the monkeypox, a rare disease caused by a virus. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Russia's defense minister has pledged, quote, adequate countermeasures against Finland and Sweden's NATO membership. Sergei Shoigu said the two Nordic countries joining NATO has led to an increase in military threats near the border. He said Russia would respond by forming 12 new units in its western military district. Finland and Sweden formally applied to join the Western Military Alliance on Wednesday. One Russian retaliatory measure involves cutting the export of gas. Finnish state-owned energy company says the flow of Russian gas to neighboring Finland will stop on Saturday morning. Gazprom has, however, assured its customers that this won't disrupt gas transmission network and supplies will continue from other sources in the coming months. U.S. President Joe Biden has met with Finland and Sweden leaders at the White House, voicing support for the two countries joining NATO. Biden has said that Finland and Sweden would make NATO stronger and enhance its security. The two Nordic states have offered their bids to join the Western Military Alliance following Russia's war in Ukraine. They have pushed ahead with their plans despite Russia's warning of retaliatory steps. Meanwhile, Turkey is opposed to Sweden and Finland membership in NATO. Ankara wants them to lift their bans on some arms sales to Turkey. Ankara also wants Stockholm to stop backing Kurdish Workers' Party or the PKK. Turkey labels the PKK as a terror group. Sweden and Finland need the approval of all 30 members of NATO to be able to join the alliance. Global food shortages triggered by the conflict in Ukraine have drastically pushed up prices. The severe supply shortfalls could mean mass hunger in future if serious measures are not taken now.
A food basket for the world. That's how Ukraine has been described for many years. It produces commodities like wheat, corn, and sunflower oil, not just for its own population, but also for people in the rest of Europe and far beyond. Ukraine has long been known for its fertile plains, and its farmland is cheaper to run than in the rest of Europe and the United States. Meanwhile, Ukraine's Black Sea ports give it easy access to international markets. The combination has made the Eastern European country a major exporter of many agricultural commodities and the world's number one exporter of sunflower oil. Food products made from Ukrainian cereals, such as corn and wheat, can be found in markets and kitchens around the world. But Ukraine's exports have collapsed over the past few months due to the war with neighboring Russia. The disruption to Ukrainian exports is sending shockwaves through the region and the rest of the world, with food prices surging to record highs. There have been many warnings that the situation could have a devastating impact. This week, Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, raised the alarm. The UN chief warned that a war could soon cause a global food crisis that may last for years. The warning comes as a conflict has cut off supplies from Ukraine's ports. The UN Secretary General said the conflict has worsened food insecurity in poorer nations due to surging prices of commodities. The latest warning comes as Russia and the West trade blame for the conflict, which doesn't seem to be ending anytime soon.
The UN chief has warned about the impact of shortages of grain and fertilizer caused by the war in Ukraine, climate change, and COVID-related supply problems. Guterres says the situation threatens to push tens of millions of people into food insecurity, followed by mass hunger and famine.
Time seems to be running out fast for the world to take measures to avert a full-blown international food crisis. According to the United Nations, global food prices are already 30% higher than the same time last year, and experts are warning that the situation could worsen very fast if it goes unchecked. The severe shortages due to the conflict in Ukraine are triggering leaders of other countries to turn to food protectionism, putting further strains on global food markets. Food prices climbed higher last week after India banned wheat exports. New Delhi argues that the curbs are essential for its own food security and also for keeping domestic prices in check. The UN chief warns that the only effective solution to the crisis is restoring Ukraine's food production and fertilizer production by both Russia and Belarus. The UN Secretary General says he is in intense contact with Russia and Ukraine, as well as the US and the EU, in a bid to restore food exports back to normal levels. Around 20 million tons of grain are currently stuck in Ukraine from last year's harvest, which, if released, could ease pressure on global markets. Antonio Guterres says overcoming the current tough situation requires goodwill on all sides. The chaos is widely blamed on the geopolitical rivalry between the West, mainly the United States, and the Russian Federation. Will they learn a lesson from the devastating impact of their tug-of-war in Ukraine?
This could have been avoided, but this was not done because we know that, of course, NATO has been expanding eastwards and keeps prodding Russia and keeps wanting to engage. And now they're asking for more and more weapons, so they want to step up and escalate the situation, which is very, very dangerous and could lead even to World War III. It could lead to a nuclear global war. So more people should be aware of the severity of the situation.
Lawmakers in the European Union have called on EU authorities to hold Israel accountable for the murder of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. The atrocity has just been debated in the European Parliament. Jerome Hughes reports.
Once again, crimes committed by the Israeli regime have been debated in the European Parliament. Lawmakers condemn the brutal murder on the 11th of May of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. She was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier.
Too often we, here in Europe, look away when the spiral of violence continues, when new settlements plans are announced, or when another journalist gets killed or wounded.
Clearly wearing press attire, 51-year-old Abu Akleh was murdered in cold blood while covering an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. During her funeral, Israeli forces attacked mourners.
The European Union is appalled by the events that took place during the funeral procession. The EU condemned this disproportionate use of force and disrespectful behaviour.
Western media and Western leaders have been accused of turning a blind eye to the international law violations continuously perpetrated by the apartheid Israeli regime in the occupied territories.
Increased settler violence around the settlements, clashes at the holy sites in Jerusalem during the Ramadan, forced evictions and demolitions in the West Bank, including of EU-funded projects.
Tel Aviv has been urged to fully cooperate with an independent inquiry into Shireen's murder. The EU says that's important in order to maintain the bloc's close partnership with Israel.
When situations like this arise, we say it is very important for this partnership to continue in its high quality, that we have clarity about things that are happening, which are actually against our principles and our values.
EU legislators urge the West not to give up on the idea of a two-state solution to end the Israel-Palestine conflict.
The tragic death of Shirin Abu Akleh is a sad reminder of the spiral of violence taking place that continues to haunt this region.
The European Parliament debate heard that Israel has killed around 50 Palestinian journalists during the past two decades. It goes without saying then that Shirin was not the first and almost certainly will not be the last. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
China has proposed launching the process to expand BRICS, which is the alliance of emerging economies comprising Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. We discussed that in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
On this segment, China's president calls for unity among the members of emerging economies known as BRICS to shape global security for all. Xi Jinping urged BRICS countries to enhance political trust and security cooperation to promote peace and development. Xi made the remarks in a virtual meeting of BRICS foreign ministers. Also speaking at the meeting, China's foreign minister said Beijing aims to expand BRICS. China will be hosting the other BRICS members, Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, for the 14th summit of the organization in late June. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have independent China specialist Andrew Loing joining us from Hong Kong, and also president of the Asia Institute, Emmanuel Pastor, joining us from Seoul. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Loing in Hong Kong. How do you view the recent comments by the Chinese president, and what kind of a role can BRICS countries assume during the current climate that we're seeing in the world right now?
The United States is seeing this as a global contest between the American-led global order and is a perceived kind of opposing camp characterized by Russia and China, coming as these two countries from different ideologies and also, as far as China is concerned, even a different race. And of course, their security concerns are not the same. So it is a big, big challenge. But as far as the BRICS countries are concerned, there is still more cooperation, more coincidence of views between Russia and China, of course, and also to a certain extent India. But let's not forget that India is also in the American camp as far as the so-called court strategy is concerned. And even Brazil and South Africa, even though they are not entirely anti-China, but they do not want to tread on America's toes. So I think that there's a big challenge. But of course, there's a call for mutual trust and cooperation is a good one, because prolonging this American kind of unilateral action is not going to solve this global contest problem, because neither side is going to back down. As far as China and Russia is concerned, both are very powerful nuclear-enabled and also intercontinental missile-enabled countries. So I think that the world needs to work on more areas of cooperation and also managing the differences.
Emmanuel Pastrich, I'm going to read one of the comments, one of the reactions that we just had. Expansion of BRICS can consolidate and broaden a political and economic space to strengthen multilateralism. Unpack that comment for us, if you agree with it, of course.
Oh, well, obviously, this dialogue does open up a potential for multilateralism that would oppose unilateralism and the concentration of the decision-making powers in global governance in the tiny handful of individuals now. However, multilateralism can mean different things to different people, and I think we have to recognize that whereas we have, on the one hand, this issue of nation states and certain nation states like the United States, of which I am a citizen, dominating and misusing power and assets and other means of control, propaganda or culture. We also have other players out there which are increasingly powerful. We have multinational private equity, some like BlackRock, which are now larger than Germany in their assets, and which are interested in playing nation states or ethnic groups against each other for profit, and these cannot be simply defined as nation states. They're a parasitic class of global elite power structures which are infecting the whole world. So what we really need from BRICS, and I'm delighted at the statement that President Xi made and the positive response, is an alternative to go back, essentially, as our previous speaker mentioned, to the United Nations, Bretton Woods, and say, which we, as we know, in the 1940s, there was a debate about what global governance should be. There was an argument for a federal system as opposed to the United Nations, which would be more inclusive, more transparent, and more democratic. And it is my profound hope the next step for this multilateralism, which the respondent mentioned, will involve institution building to totally remake the United Nations so that it is democratic in nature, transparent in its administrative form, and scientific and human-based, not corporate-based, not finance-based, in its perspective.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Independent China Specialist Andrew Leung joining us from Hong Kong. President of the Asia Institute, Emmanuel Pastor, joining us from Seoul. Thanks for sharing your comments with us here on News Review. With that, it brings us to an end of the News Review. Do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here on Beast. Stick around.
Australia has reported its first case of monkeypox, a disease caused by a virus which is a member of the same family of viruses as smallpox. Australia detected the case in a man who recently arrived in Melbourne from Britain. Two of the infected patients in the UK had traveled from Nigeria. Other European countries, including France, Spain, Italy, and Portugal, as well as the US and Canada, have confirmed cases too. Monkeypox was first recorded in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in the 1970s. It is now common in Western and Central Africa. The disease spreads through a very close contact with an infected person. It can enter the body through broken skin, eyes, nose, and the mouth. The symptoms include fever, headaches, and skin rashes. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. A new study published in the journal Environmental Research Letters shows that keeping global warming below the key 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold by the end of the century will require not just halting the construction of new fossil fuel infrastructure, but also shutting down many existing sites. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Study Warns Many Fossil Fuel Sites Must Be Shut Down to Avert Climate Disaster. Here's more. new study published recently in the journal Environmental Research Letters shows that keeping global warming below the key 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold by the end of the century will require not just halting the construction of new fossil fuel infrastructure, but also shutting down many existing sites. Led by Kelly Trout of Oil Exchange International, the study estimates that 40% of fossil fuel reserves at currently operational development sites across the globe must be left in the ground if the world is to have a 50-50 chance of adequately slashing carbon emissions and limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or below. If fossil fuel reserves at existing sites are extracted, the researchers find nations will substantially exceed the 1.5 degrees Celsius carbon budget that corporations and governments are already burning through at an unsustainable clip. The paper, which relies on a commercial model of the world's 25,000 oil and gas fields, leaves unanswered the question of precisely which existing development sites should be shut down, noting that it requires considerations of equity and of the best mechanisms to manage a just transition away from fossil fuel jobs and revenues within and between countries. One recent analysis suggests that some of the largest fossil fuel companies in the world are planning or already operating more than 190 carbon bombs, huge oil and gas projects that could unleash nearly 650 billion tons of CO2 emissions and doom efforts to avert climate catastrophe. Our findings show that halting new extraction projects is a necessary step, but is still not enough to stay within our rapidly dwindling carbon budget, said Greg Mutich of the International Institute for Sustainable Development, a co-author of the new study, adding, some existing fossil fuel licenses and production will need to be revoked and phased out early. Mutich added, governments need to start tackling head-on how to do this in a fair and equitable way, which will require overcoming opposition from fossil fuel interests. The research comes as the fossil fuel industry is exploiting to lobby for new fossil fuel development. In late March, the Biden administration pledged to ramp up U.S. gas exports to European Union members as they attempt to wean themselves off of Russian fossil fuels. Climate advocates warned that the White House's initiative would likely spur the construction of new pipelines and other fossil fuel infrastructure, potentially locking in more planet warming pollution, as scientists say emissions must be halved by 2030. Our study reinforces that building new fossil fuel infrastructure is not a viable response to the conflict in Eastern Europe, said Trout, Oil Change International Research Co-Director, adding, the world has already tapped too much oil, gas, and coal. Developing more would either cause more dangerous levels of warming if fully extracted or create a larger scale of standard assets. Tris van der Graaf of Ghent University in Belgium, a study co-author, similarly cautioned that each new coal mine, gas well, or oil field that is developed deepens political entanglement with the fossil fuel industry. Increasing the scale of extraction-related jobs and investments, he added, only makes it harder for governments to manage.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Now, how insane can you be and still become president of the United States? Many thought and still believe that Donald Trump is crazy. Clinton was labeled a narcissist, Nixon paranoid, and Theodore Roosevelt bipolar. John F. Kennedy was said to have psychopathic traits, and Abraham Lincoln experienced suicidal depression. Now, with Joe Biden trying to shake hands with an invisible being, calling his vice president the president and first lady, the White House had to send the Easter Bunny to save Biden from saying something crazy. Anything can happen in America these days. While questioning the sanity of Biden, one starts to think if any president was sane going into the White House in the first place.
Cuckoo's Nest, a.k.a. the White House.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll discuss the mental state of the U.S. president. What are the conditions for a president to be deemed unfit to carry out his duties? What do the American public think about the president's mental stability? And what will happen if the president is unfit for the job, and who decides if he is or is not? As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our program, David Cadillo, Director of Education for the Center for Political Innovation and founder of San Angelo Solidarity from San Angelo, Texas, and Dr. Rick Stagenborg, retired psychiatrist and political activist, joining us out of Oregon. Stay tuned.
In 2006, a study conducted by the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease concluded that half of the U.S. presidents between 1776 and 1974 were mentally ill. Half of the mentally ill were depressed, including James Madison, Dwight Eisenhower, and notably Abraham Lincoln, who was also believed to suffer from psychosis. 20% were alcoholics, which includes Richard Nixon, whose staff struggled so he wouldn't make important decisions in the evenings. Another study in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology from 2012 concluded that JFK was a psychopath, but added that certain features of psychopathy are tied to successful interpersonal behavior.
Now, as American mental health concerns are on the rise, and according to a survey by the CBS Health and Morning Consult, about 60% of Americans experience concerns about their own mental health or of family and friends. The mental state of the person running the country is also a subject of discussion. According to a Morning Consult November poll, 50% of voters surveyed disagreed that Joe Biden is in good health. So can you explain the question of mental stability of U.S. presidents going on today in America?
It's actually very interesting. I did some research into the topic, and it seems that many presidents over the years have had their mental stability called into question, but never to the extent we're seeing now over the past two administrations. It's literally night and day. Even George Washington himself, the founder of our country, had his mental stability called into question, but that's something you don't learn about or something that isn't widely talked about. But these things are much more overblown than they have been in the past, and I think that really has to do with the extreme polarization that we've been seeing in America today. No longer can you have a general conversation with somebody without it becoming so extremely political charged in one direction or the other that name calling and slurs of any sort are the obvious outcome whenever all rational debate goes out the window. So you're going to have these little spits and spats. And I think that's what has caused the recent uptick in the question of mental stability.
Now, President Joe Biden, when elected, was asked about potential fundamental disagreements with his vice president and said that he'll come up with some disease and resign, although he did not specify if he meant that he'll have to resign or Kamala Harris, but it doesn't seem to be difficult for him to come up with a disease. Now, in that Morning Consult November poll, we told you about 48% of voters surveyed believe that Joe Biden is not mentally fit. And before Donald Trump, were there other cases of presidents believed to be unfit to serve in the U.S. high office?
Yes, there have been a couple of cases, at least. Woodrow Wilson suffered a massive stroke, and the evidence shows that his wife was probably in charge of the White House at that time. And then there was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, didn't die immediately after his stroke, and there's some question of who was running the White House for a while before he died. I think there was not a transfer of power at that time, but I guess now that I think about it, I couldn't swear to that last one, sorry. But yeah, this is the first time since then, for sure. There was some speculation, of course, during the Reagan years, and he actually did turn out to be in the early stages of dementia, but nothing like this where there was official questioning in some quarters.
Even though the United States has never been short of crazy presidents, and U.S. politicians call each other crazy all the time, the situation seems as though it's becoming worse.
I walked into the cabinet room. You had the group, Crying Chuck, Crazy Nancy. I tell you what, I've been watching her, and I have been watching her for a long period of time. She's not the same person. She's lost it. It was sad when I watched Nancy all moving, the movement and the hands and the craziness. And I watched it. That's, by the way, a person that's got some problems. I'm an extremely stable genius.
The president is old. Donald Trump was the oldest president at 70 years of age when he took office. And just 4 years later, Joe Biden broke his record while being 78 years old when he was inaugurated.
Well, when we talk about the age of presidents, we have to look back at what past presidents have done in regards to the issues of aging presidents and the questions of their mental stability. During the Carter administration in 1944, they actually attempted to create a mental health monitoring agency for the president of the United States, which would do routine evaluations to see if the president's mental stability was still in a fit state. But as we know now, that commission never got its legs and has not become an official part of the U.S. government's system of checking a president, making sure that everything is up to code, everything's what the people desire. Now the only check in that regard is the campaign trail and the performance in office.
Above all,
Joe Biden has been caught on camera trying to shake hands with an invisible being. The State Department and the White House were on occasion forced to clarify Biden's words and statements, calling them his own personal views and not the policy of the administration. Biden has also referred to Vice President Kamala Harris as the president and at another time the first lady. He also called Michelle Obama the vice president. Just recently, the Easter Bunny had to rescue Biden and take him away when he was asked the question by a reporter at the White House Easter egg roll.
The bigger question is who makes those decisions in the first place? Is he just reading off somebody else's script or not? And I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek, of course, because the president does speak off sometimes not off a teleprompter. He's famous for making gaffes, even when his mental faculties were not in question. But the kind of things he's saying now are very dangerous, and really you wouldn't expect a person with his background to say. They're not gaffes. They're incredibly hard to explain after the fact. And this is a perfect example. I mean, calling for essentially calling for the overthrow of another government when he pretends that the United States is not into regime change is a crazy misstatement for somebody with all his faculties.
The divide in the U.S. is becoming larger and the political establishment weaker and less fit to govern. With two consecutive presidents being constantly called crazy, and pressure has been increasing from the public and other politicians for them to step down or have the 25th Amendment to be invoked. Now, these calls were especially done during the time of Donald Trump, where many felt that he was dangerous and should not have the power over the nuclear bomb.
The 25th Amendment clearly states that if a president is physically incapacitated, mentally incapacitated, or deceased, that it would go into a line of succession, starting with the vice president, then going on to the Senate majority leader, and then yada, yada, yada down the line. And I think those are things that are seriously need to be used. There is a reason that these mechanisms were put inside of the Constitution, and it is to weed out these sort of mentally unstable applicants, no matter how that be. And I know, especially nowadays when talking about the field of mental health and mental stability, it's so politically charged that you can't touch it with a 10-foot stick without somebody calling you some sort of hater of disabled people or some things. But these are very serious issues. And as somebody who knows many people who have struggled with mental health issues, I think it's very serious that we take these topics and not brush them aside, because we need to be seriously asking, are these people mentally fit? Are they stable enough to be able to go and lead this country, the second largest economy in the world? It's not taking over to drive my car or something. This is taking over the keys to a huge, massive military, economic superpower.
The 25th Amendment has been put in place so when the president is removed, dies, or resigns, he would be replaced by the vice president. Also, when the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress declare that the president is unable to carry out the duties of the office, the president might be removed from power through a process and replaced by the vice president.
A really hypothetical situation. I think it's incredibly unlikely that that's going to happen. If it did, it would probably be a political reason, such as if Biden suddenly got so demented that he started talking peace in Ukraine, then they might do something like that. And it's hard telling what the deep state would be willing to do at that point. They've proven that they'll do whatever it takes to keep themselves in power. We saw that during the Kennedy administration. We saw that when they got rid of Carter with the October surprise. There's many, many examples that they'll do what it takes.
Some conservatives like TV host and political commentator Tucker Carlson have asked that the 25th Amendment be invoked because of Biden's cognitive decline. He has said that Biden, who is 79, cannot control his emotions due to his age, and that his behavior is more dangerous than the one of Trump's.
Focus on this man, what he's doing, that no president has ever done. No president.
No, I haven't taken a test. Why the hell would I take a test? Come on, man. That's like saying you, before you got in this program, if you take a test where you're taking cocaine or not, what do you think, huh? Are you a junkie?
What do you say?
I'm not out of time. You spoke over time, and I'm going to talk. Here's the deal. Here's the deal. The fact of the matter is, look at what's happening here.
Well, that's not true. You're saying things you do not know what you're talking about. No one said that. Who said that?
Who
said
that?
You said I set up my son to work in an oil company. Didn't that what you said? Get your words straight, Jack.
Now, Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward has said that a crazy president could on his own trigger a nuclear war. He says that the country needs to perform the operation of the 25th Amendment because in 2020, the military feared that an unstable Donald Trump was about to order a nuclear strike on China. So are key decisions being made by unstable and unfit presidents?
You know, I think when we talk about who's making the key decisions through the State Department, through the presidency, we can clearly see a pattern growing throughout most U.S. presidents in our modern era, especially. It's that they service imperialism and they service the forces of the State Department that a lot of us would call the deep state. And saying this phrase, the deep state, it's people say, oh, it's just some conspiratorial nonsense that's going on. But when you really think about it, it is just the positions inside of the U.S. State Department in which do not require elected officials to hand out those positions. There are people who move up through the ladder over and over, year after year, the revolving doors from different ABC alphabet government agencies through high-paid Raytheon, New York Times, you name it. These places are just revolving doors for imperialism, and the powers that be will be pushing through their agenda, whether it be a red person in the White House or a blue person in the White House. So,
in 2017, forensic psychiatrist and president of the World Mental Health Coalition, Bandy X. Lee, edited a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which is essays warning about the dangers of Trump's mental instability and that his psychological problems make him dangerous. Dr. Lee's teaching position at Yale University was terminated in 2020, since according to the university, Lee broke the Goldwater Rule. What are the implications of an unstable president?
The implications, I'm sure I don't have to tell anyone listening to this program, would be absolutely disastrous potentially. The nuclear codes can be activated by the president at a few minutes' notice. I heard this going up a lot in schools. 1 minute, a president could be sitting in his Oval Office, White House office, and then 3 minutes later, he could walk outside and launch nuclear weapons at any place in the entire world. And that is real power that the president of the United States holds. And if we're not making sure that that power is kept under the correct hands, we're essentially playing with a lighter inside of a match factory. We're playing with something we know has extremely deadly power, and yet we're just not having the proper precautions to be able to dole out and make sure there's restraints on this power.
Republican pollster Neil Newhouse has noted that an impacting factor in Biden's low approval ratings is his clear difficulties in communicating. He reiterated that the president is losing support in black voters who are his most loyal Democratic segment of the electorate. When asked if she would support Biden in 2024, one respondent joked, "If he's alive."
It's a little hard to tell. You have to really examine people serially to see how much difference there is. With Trump, from what I've seen, it's a little harder to tell whether he had any deterioration. He wasn't terribly swift in the first place. And Biden, while he's no intellectual giant, he certainly was better organized in the way he presented himself and the way he spoke a decade ago than he is now. But he's also doing much better than he did during the campaign. Now, people have to realize that during a campaign, it's an exhausting schedule. And for most people of that age, they would show some cognitive deficits. I would, and I'm younger than him. I know when I get fatigued, I have some problems with memory and articulation and word finding. For somebody of his age, it's a bigger problem. Not for everybody. I mean, we all know people in their 90s who are sharp as a tack.
Now, it's unclear how crazy or mentally ill you have to be before you're considered unfit for the office of the President of the United States. But given the mental state of many U.S. presidents and that many believe that the president is more of an actor than an actual decision maker, it seems that the question shouldn't be about a president being unfit to carry out his duties because of his mental illness, but quite the opposite. How crazy must one be to be able or allowed to become president of the United States? And now it's time we see what Abbas Mohtarim has prepared for us.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. On today's episode, we're going to take a look at the facade of the Democrats and Joe Biden being seen as quote-unquote less evil in comparison to Donald Trump and the Republicans. You know, it's no secret that in the 2020 presidential election, Joe Biden was seen as the less evil choice and that he was so much of a better option than Donald Trump. And it's very clear that both of them have some type of mental disorders. I mean, white supremacy itself. It's got to be considered as some form of psychosis, as literally they think they're superior to black people and people of color, which is just comical. But anyway, why is it that Biden is seen as better than Trump? Is it because he's less outwardly racist? Is it because he isn't as overtly and loudly fascist like Donald Trump? The last time I checked, a fascist is still a fascist. We have to call Biden exactly what he is, which is a white settler and an imperialist. And his policies from his administration are wreaking havoc on the world. And it's funny that people think that Biden and the Democrats are somehow less racist. And people sometimes have the nerve to utter the word progressive in reference to Biden and the Democrats. But in reality, Joe Biden and the Democratic Party, they are neoliberals, which is a conservative right-wing ideology, which was actually popularized by none other than the devil himself, Ronald Reagan. It's the same Ronald Reagan that is responsible for the student loan crisis that we're in today. The same Ronald Reagan who was part of the war on the Black Panther Party. And this is the ideology. Neoliberalism is the ideology of Joe Biden and the Democrats. Yet election year after election year, we are told to vote for whoever the blue person put in front of us. And that is the better option than the Republicans. And if we look at Joe Biden's presidency, he has expanded the police state by encouraging states and localities to use the $350 billion granted to them in the COVID-19 relief package to hire more cops. And the last time I checked, COVID is a virus. And when do cops stop a virus? And instead of building hospitals and improving healthcare and hiring doctors, instead the U.S. government, they said they don't care about the people. And the U.S. government, they do exactly what it does, which is build up its police and build up its military infrastructure so it can occupy black and brown communities. And if we look at Biden's military spending, Biden literally outspent Trump last year, and he is currently requesting that Congress pass $33 billion in requested Ukraine funding. Yet hundreds of thousands of people living in America are living houseless on the street. Black people in Flint, Michigan still have lead in the water. But this is the lesser evil in comparison to Trump. Biden and his administration, they'd rather fund a proxy war than help the poor. Biden also approved the sale of $735 million in precision-guided weapons to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. He also sold $650 million worth of missiles to Saudi Arabia, which is dropping bombs on the people of Yemen with the help of the U.S. and European allies. And these are just a few examples of Biden's militarism. Yet every single election year, they tell us to vote Democrat. But the way I see it and the way that it is evil is evil, whether it's red or blue. And both the Democrats and Republicans work together for their common interests of settler colonialism and imperialism. And why should we vote for evil? Why should we vote for evil? All this, it really just exposes America for what it is. Because in reality, America is simply a one-party state. And the ones who are in control are the corporations who make billions upon billions of dollars off of exploiting the people. And it's up to the people to make the changes. As it's very clear, it's clear today that both the Republicans and the Democrats are two settler parties and will never be interested in freedom and independence for the people. We must become our own liberators and free the land from Euro-American control. This is Power to the People.
And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.